A lot has changed this past year, but NHPR's commitment to serving you has not changed at all.
And as a public radio community, we lean on each other. You rely on us for connection, for accurate, independent journalism when you need it most.
And we rely on you to help sustain this essential community resource.
And right now, when you become an NHPR sustainer at $13 a month,
you can choose to give 13 meals to the New Hampshire Food Bank to help local families in need.
Give now at nhpr.org and thank you.
Nobody deserves to be hungry, and we've got the opportunity to change that.
Eileen Laponis is the executive director of the New Hampshire Food Bank, a longtime partner of NHPR.
Well, much like NHPR, we have a responsibility to reach every corner of the state. We're trying to further our impact and not just feed the hunger, but nourish the health. And together we do that.
Become an NHPR sustainer today at $13 a month and choose to give 13 meals to help feed local families in need at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. There's a familiar pattern that defines New Hampshire's long-standing education funding debate. A group of school districts files suit. They say the state's over-reliance on local property taxes to pay for schools hurts their community's taxpayers and students. Lower courts agree, and the suit gets kicked up to the state Supreme Court. The high court also agrees and tells lawmakers and the governor to fix it. Then political leaders discuss it, appoint commissions and study groups, make some tweaks and temporary fixes, and several years pass. But eventually, holes in these fiscal patches appear and the cycle repeats itself. Last week, the latest chapter in this almost 30-year saga was heard in arguments before the state Supreme Court on Thursday. And so today in The Exchange, we ask why we're still hearing these cases and what the chances are this one will end any differently. Listeners, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Bill Ardinger, tax attorney and a member of the New Hampshire Commission to Study School Funding. Also, Natalie LaFlamme. She's an attorney based in Concord. She's also been involved in this issue. And Liz Canada, Director of Policy and Practice at Reaching Higher NH, a public education policy group. Welcome, everybody. And my first question to you is perhaps the hardest one. Why are we still seeing these cases? It has been 27 years since the case known as Claremont 1 was decided in the state Supreme Court in 1993. Natalie, you first. What do you think?
We're still seeing these cases because the state still hasn't fixed the problem. So, like you said, Claremont 1 came out in 1993. The courts have been very patient, deferring to the legislature to come up with some formula that will pass constitutional muster, and the legislature has failed to do so. So parties keep going back to the courts to try again.
Natalie, you've been talking about your sort of personal connection with this as well. You grew up in Berlin, now you're an attorney involved in this issue. What is that story?
Right, so born and raised in Berlin, proud graduate of Berlin High School. And I think for me, when this really came to my attention was when I went to college. I attended Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. And going from Berlin schools to Georgetown was a bit of a culture shock. And a lot of my classmates, including classmates from other towns in New Hampshire, it was very clear their school experience was different. The resources and opportunities they had in their public schools seemed to exceed mine. And when I came back and started practicing law in New Hampshire, a lot of attorneys were talking about this issue, and it just kind of clicked for me. Oh, so that's what it is. It comes down to property taxes, and there's such a disparity in New Hampshire.
And just briefly, Natalie, can you explain your connection with this current lawsuit that was heard before the High Court on Thursday?
So I am one of the co-authors, along with Attorney John Tobin, on an amicus brief that represents 26 other school districts in the state.
Okay. How about you, Bill? You've been watching this issue for a long, long time. Why do you think we're still here?
Well, thank you, Laura. It's great to be on the show with you. I want to start by, like Natalie, saying I am a proud graduate of Claremont's Stevens High School. And as you know, Claremont was one of the original plaintiffs in the Claremont named Claremont lawsuit.
Right.
And I think that we are still here so many years after the original lawsuit because we have failed as a state to focus on what I believe is the real problem, which is directing state resources to help the towns and cities who are most in need, who have greater needs in terms of students who are learning English as a second language, free and reduced lunch students, students with disabilities or special education needs. We have not focused on targeting and directing resources in a fair way that helps the communities like Berlin, like Claremont, provide an opportunity for a constitutionally adequate education for all their students. I think one of the reasons we are there is that some people have focused on the problem with that we're facing, not as an effort to equalize or make more fair the distribution of total spending resources, but rather to achieve a tax policy goal principally. And that is in part, I believe, due to a very important difference between New Hampshire's court cases that address school funding and other states like Massachusetts. New Hampshire's court cases did not find ever that the New Hampshire system denied a fair chance for students of Claremont or students of Berlin. Rather, it issued in 1997, the Claremont II decision, a decision that was focused on an unclear suggestion that there had to be a state component.
Bill, we lost you there for a second. Could you repeat that last sentence that you just said, please?
Yes, sorry. I think the Claremont II court issued a decision that did not focus on distribution and fairness of resource distribution, but rather focused on a tax argument that said we have to use state taxes to fund public education to a great extent, but it's unclear. That standard, I believe, has differentiated New Hampshire from a state like Massachusetts, where they issued a 93 decision. They found that the system denied the rights of children in poorer communities. The legislature responded by directing aid to those poorer communities. And years later, the Supreme Court in Massachusetts said, the legislature is doing a good job. We haven't gotten that point yet.
Liz, how about you? Why do you think we're still having these conversations 27 years after the original lawsuit that got this started?
I think Natalie and Bill have really summed up well that, you know, the issue is still the same 27 years later. And, you know, they're both from communities that we hear a lot about in the school funding discussion. You know, Berlin and Claremont are spoken about so often in these cases. I'm a recent transplant to New Hampshire. I hate to admit that perhaps, but, you know, I moved here about 3 years ago, and I'm also looking at this from the lens of a step parent. You know, when our elementary school boys go into their classrooms, we see, you know, they have pretty nice technology. They have smaller class sizes. They have, you know, right now during this remote learning, you know, our older has his own Chromebook that comes home. And that's not the case around the state. And that hasn't been the case around the state in terms of equitable resources and ways to be able to raise those funds locally, because we are reliant on the property wealth of a community to fund our schools.
Well, it's interesting to hear your view as an outsider. And you're right. I've been watching this issue for a long time, as has Bill and Natalie. So what is that outsider's view, Liz? Because New Hampshire is not the only state to struggle with this, although other states have found, you know, other ways to manage it.
Sure. So I think, you know, as an outsider, I think one distinct difference is, you know, what happens at our local level. So, you know, for listeners who might not be aware necessarily, you know, in New Hampshire, we get to vote on our school district budgets at the local level for those of us who live in towns. And that's something that is extremely unique to New Hampshire compared to the rest of the country. So, you know, when I moved here, I was like, oh, this is a very different process than what I'm used to in other places. But how we fund our schools, the balance is also very different than other states in the country. We Our state is number one in the local reliance on school funding, and not even close to who number two is. So I think that is a distinct understanding that I had as I moved here to New Hampshire.
Well, and Natalie, the case now before the High Court, and as you told us earlier, you're co-author of an amicus brief supporting that suit. How different does this case feel from earlier cases that we've seen, Natalie, if at all?
So this case, the petitioners, the way they brought this case is a little more focused. They didn't challenge the overall system per se. They really looked at five categories of expenses, things like transportation, food services, superintendent costs, and said that they're not part of the state's definition of adequate, which means the state isn't funding these parts of an adequate education. And they asked for an injunction and for the court to basically award them the amount of money that they've spent on those in the past couple years that they believe is owed to them by the state. When the trial court looked at this, the trial court looked a little more big picture and looked at the entire statute and said, the whole thing is irrational and unconstitutional to the point I can't even judicially review it in a meaningful way, and just invalidated the whole statute. So that is what is up the Supreme Court now. And so what's interesting is this is a very similar case. The underlying issues are the same. Just procedurally, it's a little different because the state's position in its brief and at the court last week, it doesn't even defend this formula or try to. It just says, well, if someone is challenging this, the petitioners here didn't go about this the right way. And they were directly asked by the court, do you think the amount you give is adequate? And they didn't answer it. They just said, well, it would be on the petitioners to have the burden of proof to show that. And they haven't done that here. So it's a little different how this case was set up and brought. But at the end of the day, it's the same issues, same arguments. I think the other difference here is the awareness in the overall community. It's not just lawyers who are kind of paying attention to this. There was such a grassroots movement the last legislative session to really push the legislature to do something. There were a lot of bills, a lot of hearings in front of the Education Committee, which is, I believe, why they set up a commission. So I think more people are watching it this time. And I think that is what distinguishes this from earlier cases.
That's interesting. And you mentioned the word adequate, and that has come up, and a lot of listeners may be thinking, yes, I've heard about that before. Here's an email from Michael who says, has the term adequate, as in adequate education, been defined? What are some contemporary examples, Michael asks, of a town failing to provide an adequate education? And Bill Ardinger, I remember whole commissions and committees and study groups looking at this idea of an adequate education. Let's just unpack this piece by piece, Bill, please. So first of all, why is this concept of an adequate education so important?
Thank you, Laura. Let me start by saying that, as you noted at the beginning, I'm a member of a current education funding study commission, and there are a number of members. When I speak about this, I'm speaking only for myself and not for any other member of the commission. But I think it's important to talk about some context and then address your question about adequacy. At the commission, we have examined some underlying facts, and New Hampshire educates about 168,000 students in their K through 12 public education system. New Hampshire spends on that $3.2 billion every year. That spending level puts New Hampshire in the top 10 in the country nationally in spending per pupil on average. And New Hampshire, like other New England states, is ranked in the top five nationally in education quality, public education quality. The spending that I'm talking about on public education in New Hampshire is the top public sector priority in terms of spending. Where the problem is, and we've identified this, is that New Hampshire's distribution of resources, that its total $3.2 billion is not viewed as fair. It's viewed as, according to the expert consultant that the commission hired, viewed as regressive, whereas in Massachusetts, their formula distributes money to poorer towns like Lowell and New Bedford to a much greater extent than to wealthier towns like Wellesley. In New Hampshire, we're distributing an amount that is on about state money, about $3,709. And that's the number per pupil, that's the number that Natalie talked about that is at issue in the Conville case. And so with that background, you could draw the conclusion, well, if New Hampshire is generally on average doing well, is spending a lot of money compared to other states, as we've said, what is adequacy? And I think what the AIR report, the expert consultant for the commission, has concluded is that New Hampshire's total spending, $3.2 billion, is sufficient.
It's just not distributed properly. Is that the conclusion?
It's just not distributed. So I think that's the real, and again, I think part of the problem is that the legislature is looking to try and define what is an adequate education. In the past, they have done it in a way that is based on input costs, which is the cost of a library, the cost of a class size, student-teacher ratio, class size, and you build it up, tick, 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 transportation. The commission is looking at a proposal that would be a revolutionary change in how to define adequacy. We'd go from that input cost method to looking at how much do you need to spend in a community to enable your children, the children of that community, to achieve a designated outcome, which is based on outputs and a series of factors to measure outputs. This is one of the most revolutionary shifts we've seen since the 1993 original Claremont One decision.
Oh, that's interesting. So instead of looking at inputs, this costs this much, that costs that much, you're looking at outputs. How well are kids doing and what does it take to have them reach those data points? It's interesting. You mentioned, Bill, you know, the cost of a library, the cost of transportation. I got to ask you, Liz, you know, unlike previous debates, this one is taking place amid a pandemic. Some districts aren't even having physical school. Liz, how does that change the dynamic or the various points that are coming up?
I'm really glad you asked that. I get that question quite a bit. I would say that the premise is, you know, school has changed so radically and therefore, you know, should school funding change radically with it? And that's just not the case because anyone who is working full-time at home and also supporting their students learning at home will know that the educators are doing so much right now to make sure that students are, you know, not just learning, but feeling welcomed into their classroom remotely, you know, getting to know them individually, sending them messages. They're working so many hours to make sure that they're supporting their students and supporting their families. The true issue here is, as we've heard in the Conval case, is what is the cost of an adequate education? Bill, you know, certainly got into the weeds of it a little bit. You know, in 2008, the legislature created this formula that set the cost of an adequate education. And that in today's dollars is about $3,700 per student. And that's meant to cover the cost of teachers, instructional materials, facilities, a counselor, a principal, and technology. And transportation is also included, but only for students in kindergarten through eighth grade, not even high schoolers. So the issue here is, you know, with the Conval suit and with the commission, they are working to figure out what is the definition of an adequate education and what is the cost to fund that, because it is the state's responsibility to fund the opportunity for an adequate education.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Natalie, talking about the commission that Bill is serving on, and I've got a long memory on this issue as well. There have been lots of other commissions, blue ribbon commissions, study committees, and so on and so forth. How hopeful are you, Natalie, about the current commission that's looking at this?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I think the big difference is a few things. Number one, as I mentioned before, that grassroots push. I think a lot more people are watching this and watching what the legislature does. I think, as Bill mentioned, it's a new way of thinking about it, not just looking at inputs, but outputs. And I think having a new paradigm might help come up with a new formula. And I think Another factor is the commission had this outside research, the American Institutes for Research, come in and do a study. And they found that the way New Hampshire does this is not fair and leads to not great outcomes for everybody. So I think having almost an objective third party come in and look at New Hampshire's system and say, there's something wrong here, I think that spurs the commission to do something and gives them a little more basis for, hey, it's not just certain New Hampshire towns saying this. An independent research institution has looked at this and said that. And if I could just really quick go back to the question that came in, I just think this is an important point I should have made before about the current Conval lawsuit. The state argued that the Conval petitioners never claimed that they're deprived of an adequate education. And very few schools have made that claim in the past. And the trial court did a great job of explaining that the constitutional right is not just to an adequate education, it's to a state-funded adequate education. So even if students are receiving an adequate education in New Hampshire public schools, it might still be a constitutional violation if the state is not actually funding it. And so a lot of local districts really step up and raise their taxes to astronomical rates to ensure that their kids do get an adequate education. Similarly, school staff and administrators go above and beyond. I would say some of the work that people in Berlin put in is nothing short of heroic. So they are still providing their kids with an adequate education, but the state's not doing it. And that is part of the problem.
So the state's not doing it. That's the way that this research says it should be done. And that's the way that the suit said, Natalie, that it has to be state funded. Is that groundbreaking? I feel like I've heard this language before, Natalie.
I don't believe it's groundbreaking. I think it's the same arguments from Claremont. And it's the same thing that the court has said repeatedly for 27 years, that the Constitution guarantees a state-funded adequate education to every student. And if the state's going to fund that with property taxes, that's fine, but they have to be constitutional taxes across the whole state, which means uniform in rate. And that's where the problem is now. Different districts have to pay very disparate tax rates because the state isn't funding enough.
And that's where the disparate rates come in. And that's where some of the problems come in, where you have some towns with very high tax rates and other towns with very low tax rates. And we're going to cover that more after a short break because it's complicated. And I want to give it the time that it deserves. So coming up, we will look at that. We will figure out why these numbers are so hard to get through and why this issue has been so hard to resolve. And we'll take more of your questions and comments. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the latest chapter in New Hampshire's long debate over education funding. The state Supreme Court heard oral arguments late last week in a case brought by four Southwestern school districts. Our guests are Natalie LaFlamme. She's an attorney who co-wrote an amicus brief supporting the suit before the high court. Also with us, Bill Ardinger, tax attorney and a member of the New Hampshire Commission to Study School Funding. And Liz Canada of Reaching Higher NH, that's a public education policy group. And listeners, as always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With us now is Julie King, superintendent of the Berlin School District, one of many who signed on to that amicus brief supporting the lawsuit. Welcome, Julie King. Good to have you.
Good morning.
So how does the current system of funding schools, largely through local property taxes, as we've been hearing, affect the schools in your district?
Well, certainly, you know, we do our best with what we have, as Natalie stated in the earlier section of the show. Our staff is amazing and go above and beyond always to provide for our students. The issue is always the struggle for stability and money that will keep systems and programs in place long term. To have some kind of reliance and scheduling and to be able to do some long-term planning. And basically that is because the money is a very grant reliant. We seek out as many funds as we can through grants. And as you know, those come and those go. And it's very difficult to hire staff and keep staff around with grant money. The property tax issue is one that is really rough on our community. We rely on the taxpayers' portion of the money because the state aid is not there to fund the majority of the per pupil cost. So we rely on the taxpayers as well as those grants I was speaking of. And for us here in town, you know, economically, it's been a challenge with the closing of the mills. We pay much more in property taxes than many other communities do. And I think a lot of that is because of the low assessed value. And also a lot of the area that we have here within the town, the city borders, is non-taxable. If you think about our national forest, our prisons, any other, you know, tax-exempt property.
Oh, that's an important point. Yeah, I think people don't realize that, you know, state property like the prison or national property like the forest or state parks, that's not taxable, Julie, because it's, you know, public property, so to speak. It's lovely. People love to visit those places. Not the prison, but the forest and so forth. But you guys don't get tax dollars from that.
Correct.
How does this relatively high tax rate in Berlin, Julie, affect your efforts to attract businesses and increase the tax base so that you can pull in more money for the schools?
It seems to be a vicious cycle, you know, as I sit in on city council meetings and hear the struggles, we're always trying to attract new businesses, but new business, you know, to build up that tax base. But new businesses don't necessarily want to come to a place with the either first or second highest tax rate in the state, which we're always vying for number one. I'm not sure quite where we stand right at this point.
Not an honor that anybody wants to have. You have signed on to this amicus brief that I mentioned, you know, supporting the current suit from the Southwestern districts that's now before the High Court. What are you hoping that will accomplish, Julie?
Just to provide the courts with more information. I think the amicus brief was well put together by Natalie and Attorney Tobin. I think that, you know, any information that the court has so that they understand the problem across the whole state, rather than just look at individual cities that or towns that may be, you know, not in the same situation that we are in, they need to have all of the information to make good decisions and get this finally settled once and for all.
What is it, Julie, that kids in Berlin don't have that you would really like them to have? What does the lack of funding mean that you can't offer to your kids that, you know, students in Bedford or, you know, Hollis might easily have?
Well, certainly Natalie spoke to that, you know, with her experiences in the system, which she was a former student of mine and a very good student, I might add. Certainly we would love to be able to provide more classes, better offerings. There's, you know, some AP classes that we just don't have the staffing to be able to offer. As well, even if we had the staffing right now, we have no space to put kids in. As you know, or may not know, with the economic problems that we've been faced with, we closed our elementary school last year.
I remember that, yeah.
Went from three buildings to two. So right now, the middle high school, we put the middle school in with the high school, and there is no available room at any time during the day. So even if we had the staffing, we don't have the space for it right now. You know, when you think about field trips, bus runs, anything that costs money is, it's, we have to pick and choose or search for grant money.
I'm interested. We talked earlier about the pandemic, and Liz mentioned, you know, the district she lives in has Chromebooks for the kids. What about technology availability in Berlin, given, you know, that there's a fair bit of remote learning going on? Do Berlin students have, you know, school-issued Chromebooks to help them learn remotely?
We do. And, you know, thankfully, when March came and we had to close, we were in a very good state as far as being able to provide remote instruction to our students. And a lot of that goes to the grants that I speak of. We, for the past 10 to 15 years, have been boosting up our technology and our in our good place. And then City Council a few years ago and the school board supported a one-to-one Chromebook initiative with students to
so at least
know,
got
help.
That taken care of.
Yeah. So we're in a good place with remote learning.
Last question for you, Julie. And again, it's good to hear from you. We talked earlier about just how long this debate has been going on and why, you know, 27 years since that Claremont One case was decided by the state Supreme Court. What do you think, Julie? Why does it seem so hard for New Hampshire to figure this out?
I think back to my childhood. I was raised in Dummer, little town north of here. And I can remember my mother being on the school board, and I can remember my aunt being an educator and having the discussion, listening to them talk about this whole issue. And that was a long time ago. And here we are again, still talking about the same thing. And, you know, I just think that we are the live free or die state. And it seems like it's more of a battle because we try to live up to that motto in some situations. And this is one of them.
Julie, it's good to talk to you, and good luck with this school year that just got underway. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Julie King, superintendent of the Berlin School District. Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions or comments about this long-standing education funding debate here in New Hampshire, and some of the particulars, like what is an adequate education, how could it be funded at a state level, is 1-800-892-6477. Our email exchange at nhpr.org. And Bill, Liz, and Natalie, let's go right to our listeners. John is calling from Mason. Welcome, John. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a former member of the Messina School Board and a former legislator. And I believe one thing that hasn't been mentioned at all here are the constitutional issues, one of which is this is all based on Article 83, which says encouragement of literature, trades, et cetera, which is clearly aspirational, not prescriptive. And so is a very thin thread that this whole argument has been based on. The other piece is that in Article 18, and in everywhere in all of our constitutions, there is a basic principle that people or their elected representatives should make decisions about spending, not appointed judges. And we've kind of turned that on its head here. Ultimately, the people of New Hampshire are the ones who should decide this, and it's going to have to be decided by a constitutional amendment or a clarification that Article 83 is purely aspirational, not prescriptive.
I'm really glad you called, John. So I will definitely ask our guests about, you know, this idea that judges shouldn't make these decisions. Why are we still going to the courts on this? But just for the sort of people who are not involved in this, you know, day to day like you are, just really briefly, if you could, John, what do you mean by the constitutional issues? Article 83 is, as you said, aspirational, not prescriptive. Now, I've heard this argument before, but I'd love for you to just put it in layperson terms for listeners who might not be as familiar with it.
And the article is written in clear English. The only problem is that it's actually two articles, one of which talks about monopolies and corporations, and the other one talking about encouragement of literature and so forth. You know, among the other things are private charity, industry, economy, honesty, punctuality, sincerity, sobriety. If each one of these were addressed by the courts in the same way that they have tried to insert themselves into the education funding issue, what would they do about sobriety? If somebody comes up with a lawsuit to the state Supreme Court saying you have to do something about sobriety, or any one of these other aspirational issues, you know, to take education as being different and making Article 83 prescriptive in the case of education, but not in all of the other things that are encouraged, is certainly inconsistent and irrational.
Well, John, I'm glad you called, and let's tackle this, guys, because John is going back to the original constitutional language that was, Bill Ardenduring, I turn to you first, used to justify, I don't know if that's the right legal term or not, the original Claremont lawsuits. So can you just shed some, again, Bill, layperson light on what John's talking about there? It's a really interesting point, and it's been made for a long time.
And I appreciate the caller raising the issue. So the issue, as a matter of constitutional law, that went to the court in 1993 was, does this particular language in the Constitution, which, you know, is very related to what's in the Massachusetts Constitution as well about education and cherishing it, is it just aspirational or hortatory, or is it obligatory? Does it create a duty on the state government to ensure that every child, regardless of where they live, has a chance for a good at public education? And the court in 1993 in New Hampshire, Claremont 1, held, yes, it is a constitutional duty. In other words, the court, which is responsible for interpreting our Constitution, concluded differently than what the caller just suggested, that it is not just aspirational. The obligation is a duty. And then the issue is, how do you implement that duty? How do you make certain that the duty is being performed well? And all of the wake of cases that have come after Claremont 1 have been struggling with the details. As you know, Laura, the devil is always in the details.
Well, seems like, especially when it comes to this issue. And I guess I want to ask you, Natalie, since you're a lawyer involved in this, John also makes the point that others have made before. This is an issue that should be resolved by elected representatives, not courts. And I wonder what you think, Natalie.
Right. So I disagree respectfully but strongly that Part 2, Article 83 of the state constitution is only aspirational. The case law and precedent in the state makes it very clear that it is not, that it is a duty. And it's not, the court didn't arbitrarily decide this. It was a very thorough, well-reasoned decision. They looked back at the legislative history. As the caller said, the word used in the Constitution is cherish. And they went back and looked, anytime you look at a law or the Constitution, courts generally try to decide what the meaning of those words had at the time it was written. And they went back and looked at laws from the 1600s, just all the debates about these laws in the 1700s, and they came to the conclusion that this wasn't aspirational. It was really important to provide an education so that citizens could participate in society and in their government. And that is today why the court has said this requirement of what is adequate has evolved, because what it requires to participate in today's society is a lot more involved than maybe in the 1700s. And to the point about this decision should be made by elected representatives, I agree. And the courts time and time again have said that. They've said it is not our role to come up with a formula to define adequate education, and they are patiently waiting for the legislature to do that. However, it is the court's role to interpret and tell people what the Constitution means. And that's what the court did in the Claremont decisions. it said, this language in the Constitution creates a duty by the state to provide this education. And then it left it to the legislature, elected representatives, to figure out how to do that and the details.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Liz, how much does this question or concern that John raises that, look, this is really not something that should be decided in the courts, how much does this come up in the public engagement that your group is doing, Liz?
Sure. So I want to talk a little bit about that because, you know, the question of, you know, should elected officials make these decisions? And I'm here to say they do make these decisions. As Natalie just said, the courts have constantly turned to the legislature and said, hey, this is your job to do this work, to change the, you know, to define adequacy and to write out the cost. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the year 2011, because the school funding system at large was radically changed that year by the legislature. First, a moratorium was put into place on school building aid, meaning that districts that wanted to upgrade their buildings, let's say from the 1800s, for example, needed to then rely on their local municipalities to do so. Second, the statewide education tax changed from functioning as a state tax to being raised and kept locally. And third, the legislature eliminated funding that's called fiscal capacity disparity aid. And that's a lot of words to mean aid for communities that have the most difficulty raising funds on their own.
Those also grants eliminated that Julie talked about, that changing fiscal environment that districts are always dealing with. Go ahead, Liz.
Right, exactly. And they eliminated the funding that provided more money for districts with higher concentrations of students in poverty. So those three school funding specific changes by the legislature were in addition to the state eliminating its 35% contribution to public sector pensions, your police, your fire, your educators, which then added $80 million in extra costs to localities beginning in 2016. So with the school funding changes that year, communities were going to lose $158 million in state funding. The legislature said, okay, here's that money as a flat rate to stabilize your budget from this change. But now it was no longer tied to student need or community need.
Well, coming up, we will talk a little bit more about that. And I do remember those changes coming out of the 2010 legislative session, resulting from the recession. There were a lot of cuts, and then all these issues started to bubble up again. So we'll pick up on that thread after a short break, and we'll keep hearing from you. Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the latest chapter in New Hampshire's long saga over education funding. Four districts sued the state last year, and the state Supreme Court heard arguments on Thursday in that case. This hour, we're asking why these cases keep coming up and what the chances are that this one will end any differently. We've been hearing from you, too, and that's great. Listeners, join us with an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 1-800-892-6477. And Natalie LaFlamme, Bill Ardinger, Liz Canada, let's go right to our listeners. William on Facebook says, an adequate education? Does one want an adequate haircut? Adequate meal in a restaurant? Adequate auto mechanic? Adequate PCP? Adequate surgeon saving your grandchild? William, I'm glad you wrote. Bill Ardinger, this word adequate has bothered people for a long time. Where does it come from?
It comes from a whole series of school financing litigation challenges across the country. A number of those, the courts in those states adopted the term adequacy. It's interesting to note that just like the caller, not all courts have agreed to do that. In the Massachusetts court challenge, which was in a McDuffie case in 1993, they said that they refused to adopt the term adequate, which was being discussed and argued about by the parties in the case, because they thought it was not a helpful word. There are members of the current Education Funding Commission who have said the same thing. To me, Laura, the adequacy term is frankly a term that misdirects attention from the real problem that needs to be addressed. You know, it's interesting that New Hampshire relies heavily on local financing. Only 32% of the total spending on public schools in New Hampshire is from the state budget. Massachusetts, a state that is often looked to as having an excellent public school system as well, is also substantially locally funded. Only 38% of their total budget is from state budget dollars. But the big difference is that in Massachusetts, they have focused their state aid so that New Bedford gets total aid of $11,382 per pupil, whereas Wellesley, a property wealthy and income wealthy town, gets under $2,000 a pupil. In New Hampshire, where we are right now, because of the confusion that exists about the role of state financing, what the court actually said in Claremont 2, we are spending $3,709 per pupil everywhere. So that Claremont and Berlin, two towns that have greater need by any objective analysis, is getting $3,709 per pupil of state aid, and Hanover or Northampton getting the same number.
Wealthier
towns. This is not, in my view, this is the core problem. The formula for distributing state aid is broken in New Hampshire, and what matters is the distribution of resources, and it is not some effort to try and provide the same amount of money per pupil in every community.
Liz, I'd love to get your thoughts on this too, the idea that New Hampshire, you know, as a state, is raising enough money in statewide property taxes to pay for education. But the problem is we don't distribute this the right way. That's the point that Bill is making, especially in making this comparison to Massachusetts. And I wonder what you think about that, Liz.
Well, when the statewide education tax was first introduced, it was in response to the Claremont 2 case. It was meant to be a uniform rate that was then, you know, sent to Concord and then distributed to make sure that we were providing equitable services and equitable educational opportunities across the state. And like I mentioned before, in 2011, that was changed. It moved from functioning as a state tax to functioning as a local tax. And what Bill's getting at with the $3,700 and the, you know, there's some additional funds also from the state for students who qualify for free or reduced price lunch, special ed services, English language learners. We have flat rate amounts for those services. So it is based on, you know, if you have one student who qualifies for free reduced lunch, you get this amount of money. Prior to 2011, there was a range. And so if you had higher concentrations of students navigating poverty, your district received more money from the state. And what we know is that over the course of a decade, the percentage of students navigating poverty in New Hampshire has increased by nearly 40%. So districts have begun seeing far more students with additional needs. And yet that flat funding is what is happening right now in our state. And so the statewide tax that is meant to be, it's considered a state revenue. It's really no different than your local property tax. It functions exactly the same as a local tax. It's just a rate set by the state.
Well, here's a couple emails from listeners who touch on this issue. Brian says, I'm so tired of this issue. Money is a way to keep score and apportion our shared wealth. Unfortunately, Brian says, it is also hoarded by some to the detriment of the rest of us. We, the voters, are childish when it comes to paying for the things we want and need for our society. Brian says, we need to be the adults in the room, stop the silly pandering, and take responsibility for our shared responsibilities. I do not want to pay any more in taxes than is necessary, but I am willing to pay my fair share along with everyone else. So that's Brian. And here's Pamela, who says, years ago, when the debate over school funding produced the expression donor towns, my husband and I were dismayed. Of course, property tax income is higher when towns have more wealthy homeowners. The fact that they do not want to share for the benefit of all children in the state is sad. All citizens benefit when the needs of children are met. The pandemic, Pamela says, has brought into sharp relief the haves and have-nots. where access to computers and Wi-Fi are concerned. This should help us see needs and want to meet them. And we should talk about this, all of you. And I'm going to turn to you first, Natalie. I'm glad Pam raised donor towns, because this was how the statewide property tax was described in the early days, that maybe Bedford would raise more money than Berlin. And if there was quote unquote leftover money in Bedford, the idea was to target that money to Berlin, which had greater need. But then towns that were donating more didn't want to be donor towns. And I just wonder what you think about this, Natalie, and whether that's a solution that might come back.
So I think that's part of the problem of not fully recognizing that this is a universal state obligation. By relying so much on local property taxes, towns think of it as just their money that should stay in their town. And that's not accurate. And I think that's where I maybe disagree a little bit with Bill. I don't want to just see state money be directed toward towns like Berlin. I would love for Berlin to get more money, don't get me wrong. But I also want kids in Rye and Multonboro to have a state-funded adequate education, because that's what the Constitution says. And this is a universal obligation. The state needs to fund that for every child in the state. And kind of having this idea of directing money to only the poor towns makes people feel like this is charity or a handout. And towns like Berlin are not asking for a handout. They're just asking for the state to meet its constitutional obligation. And that's the problem with thinking of it as not a statewide issue by just looking at local taxes, because people do feel like they're donating to other towns, and that's not fair. And I think we need to keep that in mind and have a paradigm shift of what this tax is really supposed to do.
So not a fan of the idea of targeted aid, Natalie. And again, you're involved in the litigation end, not the sort of policy and how money should be raised end. But it sounds like the idea of targeted aid from this statewide property tax, you feel like is part of the problem?
No, I would like to see targeted aid. And I think that comes from adequate might look different in different towns, and the cost of providing an adequate education might look different. And that's where Liz was explaining this earlier, that the state has an adequacy grant, and then they have differentiated aid for how many students you have who are special ed or sure. on free or reduced lunch. And so it is targeted more. And so what I'm saying is I want everyone to have a state-funded adequate education, and maybe that means you send $12,000 to Multonboro and you send $17,000 to Berlin, but I don't think we can only direct money to certain places. But I do strongly think that some places do need more money directed there.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So all of you, just to finish up, and boy, we could talk for another 4 hours, I think, on this. Just, Natalie, to you first, remind us of what the next steps are, since you are involved in the legal end of this. Again, co-author of that amicus brief supporting the lawsuit before the High Court. So what's the next step for you and the other lawyers involved, Natalie?
So the immediate step is to wait with bated breath for the New Hampshire Supreme Court to come down with a decision, which can be several months. And it'll really depend on what that decision is and where it goes from there is what we do. Our amicus brief really tried to encourage the court to put a little more pressure on the legislature and not just say, it's their role, we'll let them handle it. I think they need a little push this time and some accountability. So we would really like to see the court come out a little stronger on that point. And if they don't, and if we still have no solution and the same issues again and again, maybe we need to try another lawsuit until it works.
Bill, you're on this state commission. What's your group's next step?
We are continuing forward to try and develop a consensus recommendation on how New Hampshire's entire complex public school finance system should be changed so that it is fairer and that it helps children all over the state, regardless of where they live. I think Natalie's point is so important. I think that the focus has to be on the understanding that children in Claremont, children in Berlin, are all of our children. The state duty is to make sure that we're not letting any children fall through a crack so that they are not able to access an opportunity for a constitutionally adequate education. I would suggest and disagree with Natalie that a focus on state budget financing is not as important as making sure that the distribution of funds is fair. And where we have failed up to now, I believe, is continuing to bump our head against the wall that people keep saying, we got to completely dump local financing. New Hampshire has high spending per pupil and highest among the highest in the country. We have high quality public education. Let's make sure we don't break the system, but rather get aid to those communities who are most in need.
Well, and Liz, just very briefly, I'd love to hear from you too. What does your group hope to accomplish this fall?
We want to make sure folks understand that public education is worth investing in. You know, Bill from Claremont, Natalie from Berlin, our graduates own businesses everywhere throughout the state. They raise family here. They drive our economy. And so it is critical that we have strong public schools that support them and are responsive to their communities.
Well, all of you, thank you again for wading through all of this with us. We really appreciate it. Bill Ardinger, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Laura. Great to chat with you. Be safe.
That's Bill Ardinger, tax attorney, a member of the New Hampshire Commission to Study School Funding. Natalie LaFlamme, great to have you too. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Natalie LaFlamme, an attorney in Concord. And Liz Canada, good to have you on the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
That's Liz Canada, Director of Policy and Practice at Reaching Higher NH. Today's show was produced by Exchange Fellow Jane Vaughn, and this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.